Welcome back, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Editor at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Raise Your Average. Mike Philbrick, CEO at Resolve Asset Management Global, is here with me. Mike, how you doing?
Very well, thank you, Pierre. Good to see you again.
Great to see you, too. Hey, before we get going, how did you come through the hurricane?
really well. It was just a passing kiss rather than a direct strike. So Beryl was a pretty significant hurricane, having effects all the way up into the eastern seaboard as it filled the hydrological cycle of North America with new water from the Atlantic Ocean. It's the miracle of the way the world works and weather patterns and all that fun stuff.
We had some brutal rainstorms here in Toronto, just like in the week following, an incredible amount of rain.
Yeah, that's Caribbean water too.
Atlantic, like a month's worth of rain in a couple of hours.
Circa 2013, so, I guess. Was that 2012 or 2013 when we had the last rainstorm? That's fantastic. Well, I'm super excited about our guest today too. An area of the market that I think is sort of underrepresented, hasn't had a big run or a big attention like we might be starting to see since probably the resource boom of that 2003 to 2009 period. So Justin, happy to have you on today and talk about what's going on.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're excited to welcome Justin Hune to the podcast. Justin is a renowned uranium market expert and the founder of Uranium Insider, a leading research and analysis platform dedicated to the uranium sector. With a deep understanding of the nuclear fuel cycle and a keen eye for market dynamics, Justin provides invaluable insights to investors navigating the complexities of the uranium market. His expertise has been honed through years of in-depth research and hands-on experience, making him a sought-after voice in the industry. So join us as we dive into the latest trends, challenges, and opportunities in the world of uranium with Justin Hune.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Justin, welcome. And again, welcome. It's terrific to have you on the show.
Yeah, really good to talk to you guys today. I appreciate you having me on.
Justin, to begin, tell us about how you began your career in the sphere that you're in now, your background, how you got into the uranium space in the first place.
The uranium trade really kind of came to me as one of the first and most exciting fundamental investments of my investing career. Prior to this trade, really, I had primarily been a technical trader. So this was, and just managing my own money, simply momentum, breakouts, technical trading was really my bread and butter. And that's what I did for close to 10 years before the thesis came to me for uranium. That was basically at the bottom for this cycle. So this was late 2016, the commodity U308 spot uranium bottomed at like $18 a pound late 2016. I happened to listen to a podcast with an interview with a CEO in the space. And it was very intriguing to me because when I started technical trading, I was lucky enough to have somebody take me under their wing and kind of teach me the ways of technical trading, right? And this had to do with very, very strict rules that you absolutely never broke. You wanted to know absolutely nothing about the company or the sector, any fundamental underpinnings for what you were trading. It was simply an unbiased, unemotional view of a chart, period, the end. That was his way of trading, right? So that's what I learned. And over the years, I started to recognize that if I was buying something for a technical reason or selling, that if I knew something about the company, if I recognized, let's say, that the breakout happened because of X, it was, a blowout quarter or whatever it might be. If I understood the fundamental reason behind something, it gave me more confidence in that trade. And oftentimes there was a lot more just general kind of momentum for that trade if there was a strong fundamental underpinning of that breakout. So that kind of got me leaning towards starting to dig into fundamentals. And then the Iranian thing came along and it was like, this sector is absolutely hated. Nobody knows about it. Nobody cares about it. Nuclear is never coming back. The commodity, like I said, it bottomed at $18 a pound spot. You know, the cheapest producers in the world, which the Kazakhs, were, even though their cash costs are very low, their all-in sustaining or fully allocated costs were for even them were higher than the price of uranium, let alone every other producer in the world, with the average cost of production being probably in the 40s or 50s at that time, you know, inflation adjusted, right? You go back, the commodity is trading well below that. So the sector was just bombed out. And this is the complete opposite of a technical breakout trade, right? This is a contrarian bet. Long term, you have no idea when it's going to recover. You have no idea how long the investment will last. But you're betting on something going from absolutely terrible to maybe just bad. And possibly in the future, maybe somehow it'll get good. Like, that's kind of the bet. Trying to buy the bottom of this cycle. And in some ways, it's like many other commodities, or most other commodities. In some ways, it's very, very different. The similarities to other commodities is that commodities are cyclical, and uranium is no different than that. You have a period of undersupply, prices rise, supply responds. You have a period of oversupply, so prices drop, production comes offline, rinse and repeat, right? And that's pretty much how commodities function, supply and demand fundamentals. Looking at uranium, it's the same in that manner, but it's different in that it's kind of like a commodity on steroids, because supply is very, very slow to respond. Uranium mines are very complex due to the fact that it's radioactive material. Oftentimes there's much more red tape than a typical, you know, hard rock mine. And so supply just takes a very long time to respond. And the industry was in, I mean, to put it simply, a lot of pain following the bear market that went really kind of from the peak, which was 2007. The commodity fell from $134 a pound into the 40s over the course of about 12 months. It was basically a crash in the commodity. It coincided with the GFC. Started to recover. There was still kind of bullish, for lack of a better word, news in the sector. China was building a lot of reactors. The price started to recover. I think it got into the 70s. And then we had the Fukushima Daiichi accident. That was in March 2011. Not only was that bad for sentiment for nuclear and for the investment world around nuclear and uranium, but you also had Japan take all of their reactors offline. They had 54 reactors. They were the second largest market in the world, or possibly third behind France. All of their reactors came offline, 10% of global demand for uranium gone over the course of about 12 months. So that was a huge shift in supply and demand, while at the same time, the Kazakhs, that at the time were 100% state-owned, Kazatomprom, and Kazakhstan produces the most uranium out of any country in the world by a long shot. They were ramping production very, very quickly. The fastest uranium production ramp that we've ever seen, right? So that was going early 2000s into the peak of their production was also 2016, coincided with the bottom of the commodity. But you had demand falling because of Japan coming offline, Germany, and a few other countries initiated nuclear phase-out policies. Some of those countries still have them, Spain, Belgium. Belgium is keeping their last few online. Spain remains to be seen. They've got five or six reactors to come offline in the next 5 years. We'll see what they do. They need that electricity, so physics might rule the day there, but we'll see. So we had demand falling. We had supply rising, and that just crushed the industry. It crushed the Western suppliers. The Canadians had a hard time. The U.S. Uranium industry absolutely decimated, and the commodity just continued to fall. And we had oversupply of uranium that dictated the pricing environment for a very, very long time. And it also dictated the manner in which nuclear utilities, who are the primary buyers of uranium, operated. So there was abundant supply coming out of Kazakhstan, abundant above ground mobile inventory because of this oversupply. The Japanese had sold inventory into the market and reneged on some contracts. We were swimming in excess uranium supply.
It reminds me of the old Don Cox adage of, you know, when those who know it best love it least. That is that is an opportunity to think about long-term returns in.
For sure. Yeah, that's
a great quote.
Yeah, that's a really good one. So bringing us up to when I heard about the thesis, it was still very much contrarian. They started to connect with people in the industry and people on Twitter who were steeped in this thesis, and you could count on two hands how many of those people there were. So I found myself in this very small, somewhat close-knit community learning more about this. The more I learned about it, the more I got excited about it, not only from an investment perspective, but I recognized that I knew nothing about nuclear energy. And this was and is, you know, almost 10% or possibly even a little bit more at this point of global electricity is produced by nuclear energy. It's almost 20% in the United States. I had no idea. I knew nothing about it. And all I knew about it was harkened back to Fukushima. And there was just so much like fear-mongering headlines around that. Not a single person lost their life in that accident. It was bad. It was a meltdown. Of course, I'm not going to celebrate it. But the silver lining is the entire world's nuclear reactor fleet, every single country reassessed their own fleets and implemented new safety protocols that largely was facilitated by the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. So it was a kind of a gut check moment for the industry, and it's turned into an incredible positive for the industry. It's a very, very safe technology. This is something that most people don't understand or know, because it's really interesting. You have kind of pop culture influence on understanding of this very, very important and very valuable energy source, like The Simpsons. People think of nuclear energy. They think of the three-eyed fish swimming in the cooling lake around the reactor, and Homer going home with a glowing, you know, orb in his hoodie. Yeah. Just things like that, you know.
Monty Burns.
Yeah, exactly. But nuclear energy, if you measure safety based on, let's say, lives lost per, however you want to measure it, kilowatt hour produced, it's the safest electricity that's ever been conceived, period. The waste is drastically overstated in terms of the problematic nature of it. It's a very, very small amount of waste that's produced by nuclear, and it's highly regulated. There's never been an accident with nuclear waste in the history of civilian nuclear energy. So this brings us, I suppose, to a couple of years in, let's say 2017, 2018, the sector continued to contract. The commodity started to recover a little bit, but then you had large producers decide to take their projects offline. Paladin took Langer-Heinrich offline. This is 5 to 6 million pounds a year out of Namibia. Cameco took MacArthur River offline, which is 18 million pounds a year. That's in Saskatchewan, Canada. Cameco also took Rabbit Lake offline. That's still offline. And the smaller producers in the United States pulled back substantially. So even though the United States is the largest nuclear market in the world, with about 25% of annual global demand for uranium, we produce basically nothing. And that's starting to recover. The gears are turning on supply in the United States. But 2024, we'll see less than a million pounds, probably half a million pounds, between half a million pounds produced in a single year in the United States this year. And we'll consume about 45 million pounds of uranium. So the industry is really doing its best to recover. But this supply came offline voluntarily in the late 20-teens. And that really helped to mop up mobile inventory. Cameco became a buyer in the market. Now, as a producer, they became a buyer, and a pretty big buyer. So instead of that 18 million pounds they were producing, they had to buy 18 million pounds in the market. And this was a significant shift. It really helped to soak up some of that inventory. But if you figure a very rough calculation of the oversupply of the 20-teens, you had probably, from what China didn't buy, an excess of maybe 150 million pounds of uranium just sitting in a can at one of the various conversion facilities being traded and sold to utilities. And so the producers just didn't get a lot of business in the 20-teens because there was so much inventory around that the main producers that their bread and butter is long-term contracts with the nuclear utilities. And they were in a world of hurt when in this bear market. And that finally started to recover, largely with the help of Cameco. And so just to kind of wrap up that 30,000-foot view, if you had asked me in 2017, let's say, or even 2018, what would be the ideal situation to see this as a long-term investment? How could the industry shift? Basically, that's happened. Finally, the environmental left is recognizing nuclear as a low carbon or zero carbon electricity source, and therefore vital for the quote unquote energy transition. You have the sector recovering. Japan is turning reactors online. There's 56 or 57 reactors under construction right now. almost half of those are being built currently in China. But the market that's most interesting to me is really in the Western world, the OECD, because they have about 70% of the world's reactors, and they also have not been building very many reactors over the last 20, 25 years. That market is starting to shift, where we're not only seeing life extensions for existing plants, that most plants in most places in the world get an initial 40-year license to operate, but they can safely operate for 80-plus years. There's even talk of potentially having reactors in the United States go out to 100 years when we cross that line. Most of the fleet in the U.S. is built in the late 70s and 80s. So getting to this current moment in time, nuclear is being increasingly embraced. It is a bipartisan supportive issue in the United States, which they agree on absolutely nothing, but Democrats and Republicans are supportive of nuclear right now. The Western market is waking up. They're recognizing how important it is to have baseload clean energy. The existing fleets are being largely life extended with few exceptions. And we're actually hearing talk of new builds even in the United States. And this was something that was not in your wildest dreams in 2017. Would you think this would ever happen? You could basically relatively simply model out future demand based on the reactors under construction that are going to come online, the existing fleet that will be operating for X amount of time. Do your calculation. This is the demand. How much supply do we have? Well, that demand is growing, and it's growing at 2 to 3 times the rate we expected it to grow even just 5 years ago. So we expected a 1, maybe 2% growth rate in nuclear globally. We're looking at 3 or 4% compound annual growth in demand right now. So it's an incredible shift in the demand, and supply, as I already said, just comes on so slowly in this sector. Those gears are turning, starting to increase, but it's increasing in line with demand increasing more or less.
And what are the, so that's quite a career arc. So you start in 16, you go through 4 years of those who know it best, like at least, but seeing the opportunity, and then you hit the 2020s and, you know, the price has gone up substantially as the markets are anticipating both, you know, maybe a nuclear renaissance, more fleets coming online, and the actual supply situation. And you mentioned a couple of things I think that you should define more clearly. Things like clean baseload power. What is that exactly? And what is that as compared to, let's say, wind or other types of energy? And how, why does nuclear fit so well into that?
Sure. Well, I mean, typically the word clean energy would describe non-carbon emitting energy. Mm. And so, which I don't think, in my personal opinion, is not necessarily the overarching definition of clean. There's plenty of other elements to coal power, for example, to biomass electricity, which is considered green, but is possibly one of the dirtiest in the overall environmental effects. So, but clean energy in general parlance is carbon-free electricity or low carbon emitted electricity, of which you have a few options. You have nuclear, you have wind, you have solar, you have geothermal, and you have hydro. And all of these are the primary generators of non-carbon emitting electricity. Of those, only nuclear, hydro, and geothermal are considered baseload. Baseload is always on electricity. It's not intermittent. It's not weather dependent. So baseload and clean is really the best electricity you can have. And there's trade-offs with every type of electricity. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Nothing is perfect. We could go down that rabbit hole if you want, but that's probably a general waste of time. But, you know, hydroelectricity is seen as clean because it's non-carbon emitting. It's unbelievably environmentally negatively impacting. Unbelievably so.
Not too many people know how many thousands of hectares get flooded ecosystems destroyed by the creation of dams that build out the hydroelectric power. And it's something that is kind of a dirty little secret. Whereas on a footprint that is much, much, much smaller, you can create the same 80 years of energy coming from a nuclear facility. So, and I don't want to derail it too much because that gets a little bit political. I think it's suffice to say the political winds are changing. Nuclear is having a renaissance because it is now being framed within the lens of both being clean and because it's baseload power, it has an even more important place in an energy plan. So I know the Ontario government has an incredibly robust nuclear plan for those who use Ontario Power. Not maybe well known, but an incredibly forward thinking plan. And maybe we can go into, so we've covered, you know, baseload power. So if it's not windy, you're still getting electrons. It's clean from, you know, an environmentalist perspective. It takes some planning. Are there some technological advancements that have come along? Certainly the CANDU reactor in Canada is pretty safe and renowned worldwide for being safe. What are we seeing globally in the technology side that's giving sort of more of the reframe and the fresh winds in the sails of nuclear legs? Is there technology stuff that's come along that's made this much more reliable as well?
It's hard to say if it's made it more reliable, but I would argue that there have been advancements in the last 20 to 30 years for the existing operating light water, boiling water reactors of the world that have increased efficiencies and have been able to allow the United States fleet, for example, to operate at much, much higher efficiencies. We're producing the same amount of electricity with 94 reactors as we did with 110 reactors right now. There's been that many that have come offline.
Right.
They're continuing to increase efficiencies, and that's, to some extent, has to do with technological advancements. There are what are considered generation 4 reactors or advanced reactors, and there's hundreds of designs of these, and there are especially 80 to 90 and possibly even more than 100 small modular reactors of the advanced nature. And advanced reactors are usually typically different designs from what we see in most of the world's large reactor fleet, which are light water, boiling water, heavy water reactors. CANDU is a heavy water reactor. CANDUs are brilliant. I don't know why we're not building more of those. It's about 10% of the world's fleet of CANDU, almost entirely in Canada. There's a handful of these heavy water reactors in India, I think in Argentina, but for the most part, it's in Canada. And it's been an absolute success story for Canadian energy, for sure. The advanced reactors are different. There's multiple different designs. There's molten salt reactors. There's gas cooled reactors. These I'm not a nuclear engineer, so it's difficult for me to describe the intricacies of these different designs. But some of the benefits of these designs are that they operate on higher enriched uranium. There's something called HALEU. It's high assay, low enriched uranium, and the typical enrichment level, with an exception of CANDUs. CANDUs run on natural uranium. But the typical enrichment level for boiling water and light water reactors is between 4% and 5% of U-235. We don't have to get geeky with that. It's the fissile isotope in uranium. Natural uranium is 0.7. They enrich it up to between 4% and 5%. HALEU is up to almost 20% in some cases. So it's much higher enriched. The fuel can last, instead of going through refueling outages every 18 to 24 months, which the current large light water boiling water reactors do, these reactors can operate sometimes 10 or 20 years without having to change out the fuel. There are new safety mechanisms built in. The reactor, I'll give you one example. They just broke ground in constructing kind of the pre-nuclear aspects of this build in Wyoming for TerraPower's Natrium reactor. This is one of the two advanced reactor designs that's being supported by the Department of Energy in the United States. It's considered a demonstration project. And this reactor is a molten salt reactor. And so it's actually, the reactor core is cooled with molten salt rather than with water. So you can place it in and you don't have to put it next to the ocean or next to a river or next to a reservoir. You can site these independent of a water source, which is a huge advantage. And this is a really interesting design. So TerraPower is co-founded by Bill Gates, obviously co-founder of Microsoft. So there's this tech and nuclear sort of alignment that's happening right now, which is really cool. And this reactor can actually store excess energy in the form of heat within molten salt, and then pull that heat back and cycle up and down more easily, which usually nuclear can't do very well. It's just kind of always on and steady. You can cycle it a little bit, but it's slow. Why is that important? The cycling of a baseload source is necessary as a backup to intermittent sources. So the more solar or wind you have in a grid, the more you have to have a baseload source that can cycle up and down. And what is that? It's natural gas, 9 times out of 10. So ironically,
that sounds like, I mean, the molten salt sounds like a battery technology, right?
It sort of acts as a battery, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, just having the ability to cycle up and down more easily and more quickly is likely to mean that reactors of this design and this style that can do that are more likely to be paired with intermittent sources in the future, because there's obviously a lot of momentum and support for intermittent sources of energy, because they're
amazing,
quite clean, right? So if we can have a baseload source that can cycle up and down and match off with that intermittent source of electricity from wind and solar, great. So that's just one example. There's so many different designs. Don't have the time. We could go hours into that. But
yeah,
there's a lot of
the technological progression is going on.
100%.
There are and there it is improving, as you might imagine. You know, so the reactors of 1970, 1980 are substantially improved in the 2020s.
They are, and there's minor technological tweaks that have been done, because it's basically just a really fancy way to boil water is what we're talking about. and so in that way, it hasn't changed. But there's a lot of nuance and a lot of technological aspects to the surrounding technology that have improved over the decades. But still, they're still building very large light water, boiling water reactors. China, like I said, they're building 27 reactors right now. And all of those are, except for one, they're building the first molten salt small modular reactor in China right now. But the rest of them are large, you know, 1,000 megawatt, roughly, light water reactors. So they're just going all up building that. Yeah.
And so, you know, alongside of that, that history in uranium, the price, the new build out, we have sort of an insatiable demand for electrons that's sort of washing over the world, whether it's AI, whether it's the technology being used across the globe for various advancements in humanity. And then we have quite a bit of the world that isn't not quite at the consumption of energy it should be at. You know, so the Western world uses probably 10 to 100 times more energy per capita than the developed world. And as the developed world keeps developing, we're going to have more demand for electrons. And so, you know, can you speak to the uranium side of things helping meet that demand, that insatiable demand for energy, and how that's going to maybe trickle through the supply demand dynamics of uranium you spoke of earlier on?
Yeah, for sure. That's I think you're touching on probably the biggest theme that's supportive of nuclear right now, and just a huge theme in general for society, let's say. And that is, the electricity is, the demand is growing across the board. It's been growing for a very long time in the East. Excuse me. India, with more than a billion people, is the, these folks are growing in wealth as the GDP continues to grow. They all want to have what we have. They want to have electric washing machines and dishwashers and air conditioners and microwaves and things like that. So you see demand rising very quickly in the East as they develop and progress towards where the West has been, let's just say, for some time. The Western demand for electricity has been relatively stagnant for about the past 20 years. That has to do primarily with, well, the population leveling off a bit. It has grown in the West, but it hasn't grown at the pace that it has in the East, right? So that's one aspect of it. You also have just general efficiencies in home building, efficiencies in lighting, just general smaller efficiencies within the electric devices that we utilize and have utilized for the last 20 years have grown in efficiency. So we've seen demand grow year over year since electricity was conceived, and finally has leveled off for the past 20 years. And now that's doing another sharp move to the upside. Why? Well, we're using more electricity. I'm in California. I can't throw a stick in my town without hitting a Tesla. So we've got, you know, 4 to 5% of the cars on the road in California are electric. And that's a lot. It's the state with the most electric cars. And most other states are not to that extent, but it's incrementally growing and moving that direction. We also have data centers growing very, very quickly, not only in California, but just to speak generally globally. The United States has a lot of data centers. China has a lot of data centers. The UK and Japan have a lot of data centers. And data centers, just literally for storing data, for doing what we're doing right now in this interview,
right,
that has absolutely exploded. and they use a lot of electricity. They run very hot and need a lot of cooling and air conditioning, and they're always on, right? So they need baseload power to power these things, and they're growing very quickly. The nitrous to this. Really, the kind of the nitrous oxide to this has been AI, and this has been something that is that has been developed over quite a few years, but it's really kind of hockey stick in the last couple of years with ChatGPT. And so this is growing very, very quickly. ChatGPT, a query in ChatGPT, to give an example, if you want to ask ChatGPT something, for it to provide the answer takes 10 times the electricity of a Google search. And this is obviously snowballing right now. And what percentage of the population is using ChatGPT? 0.001. I mean, it's going to grow very, very quickly. But there's also just everybody is using AI in terms of large corporate, especially technology companies. And so AI is exploding. The tech companies are buying up land like crazy in Northern Virginia to establish more data centers. And there's the most in Virginia out of any other state in the United States, probably due to its proximity to DC. But this is a huge growth situation. And to give you kind of some perspective on this, if you look at the most recent quarterly conference call for Dominion Energy, that is an operator in the United States, they operate a number of nuclear reactors and have also other sources of electricity. Just 2 years ago, Dominion's 10-year plan saw electricity demand for their utility growing, I think it was 7 or 8% was what they put out 2 years ago. They revised that recently, and in the most recent quarterly call, they're expecting electricity demand for Dominion themselves to more than double in the next 10 years. And that's how quickly it's shifted. And it's not just for Dominion, it's for basically all the US operators. And we're seeing the same thing happening in Japan. Like I said, Japan, China, the UK, these are all big data center countries that are all growing very quickly. And they also happen to be large nuclear markets. And why is that important? It's important because the electricity demand is not going to allow these facilities to come offline, in our estimation. To speak very broadly and generally, we believe most of the reactors that are operating, especially in countries that have electricity demand growth, which is most countries, literal physics is going to require that the current source of electricity be continued. And we're already seeing that in the US. We're seeing talk of restarting reactors in the United States. There's three reactors that are currently in the process of potentially restarting. It's Duane Arnold in Iowa, it's Palisades in Michigan, and it's the unit one at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. They're talking about fully restarting. If that's not a sentiment signal, I don't know what it is. So it's very, very bullish for nuclear, especially when it comes to the preservation of the existing fleet. And of course, modeling out supply and demand, you expect some reactors to come offline as year over year progresses. And many of those are not going to come offline as expected, which is an immediate influence on the demand for uranium.
Yeah. And there was, for example, the direct link between, you know, data centers and nuclear was the Amazon deal with Talon, right? Where, you know, they took over Talon's data center right adjacent to the nuclear plant that Talon operates.
Yeah, right? That was earlier this year, the Susquehanna plant in Pennsylvania. And I learned at a recent nuclear energy conference that it's looking like one of the two reactors at that power plant is literally going to be disconnected from the grid and serving only this data center. And it's sort of becoming and likely will be a point of contention, not necessarily for this particular situation, but the tech companies need the energy. They need it. And they're not going to be denied. There's also geopolitical implications with all of this. China is moving into AI extremely fast, and there's a lot of concerns for the United States. I think it's almost like kind of a it's an arms race in some sense. How quickly can we get a grasp on this thing to be able to protect national interests, etc.
I saw that news too, the enrichment of uranium coming back to the United States of America too, because you've got the major supplier in the world as you pointed out earlier, is Russian. That's a bit of a point of contention from a supply chain security perspective. And then you've got the enrichment process that is largely, I think it's entirely not done in the U.S. at the moment. And this is a move towards actually enriching the U.S. But correct me if I'm wrong there on my factoid.
You're not wrong. So enrichment is one of the aspects of the nuclear fuel cycle. So uranium that comes out of the ground is just the pure commodity. It goes through some mild processing to produce what's uranium octoxide, which is U308. It's the yellow cake. It's the yellow powder that you'll see, you know, stored in a 55-gallon drum. The uranium then has to be converted into a gas. That's known as conversion. The gas is called uranium hexafluoride or UF6. And the UF6 market is also a very big market. The nuclear utilities can and do buy their uranium in multiple forms across the fuel cycle. So you have uranium mining, then you have that converted into a gas into UF6. And UF6 has to be enriched, unless you're talking about a CANDU, but generally speaking, has to be enriched up to that 4-5% level. And from there, and that's done in centrifuges. So it's the UF6 is spun very high speeds and the isotopes separate. That gets you to that enriched uranium. It's deconverted back to a solid form, and then it's fabricated into fuel pellets and fuel rods. And this whole process takes about 2 years, maybe a year and a half, if all of those services are located relatively near each other. So basically, the fuel cycle takes a long time, and the utilities can purchase anywhere in that fuel cycle. And their end product is fabrication, right? So they need fabricated fuel rods. That's the thing that goes into the reactor core. And if they can buy the product of one of the processes closest to fabrication, they will. So if you can buy enriched uranium in the enrichment level that you need and skip buying uranium and having it converted, buying conversion, you'll do that. And so to your point, Mike, Russia is the largest provider of both conversion and enrichment globally. And there has been somewhat of a bifurcation of this market since the invasion of Ukraine. The Western utilities have largely, not entirely, but largely voluntarily stopped doing business with Russia. So that's not to say that they're not still receiving deliveries of contracts they signed years ago, but engaging in new business, signing new contracts with Russia. So the United States has, they have barely any enrichment whatsoever. The only real domestic enrichment comes from a company called Centrus. The centrifuges are owned by the federal government. Uranco is a UK and Dutch owned company that operates in the United States, but it's owned internationally. Still considered domestic enrichment, but it's insufficient capacity for both of those entities to even serve the US fleet. So the United States has 20% of its electricity coming from nuclear. We don't have enough uranium mining. We don't have enough conversion. We don't have enough enrichment. We've got fuel fabrication. We have conversion, but the capacities are small in both of those things. So as part of this sort of nuclear renaissance and this resurgence of nuclear support in the United States, there's support coming from the federal government for some of these processes. They just issued last month a request for proposal for enriched uranium. So there, and that's $3.4 billion in funding to buy enriched uranium coming from domestic sources. So they're trying to spur on the industry, which is overall, I think, a good thing. But Russia,
that seems to have become a real problem across the board with commodities, with the whole commodity complex. Is that, you know, we're offshoring all the dirty work, and you know, either to developing countries or, you know, in the case of uranium, it's Russia, you know, the new sworn enemy of the West, and you know that does present a huge supply constraint.
Yes.
Or, you know, political problems as well, but geopolitical problems, but the supply constraint is obviously motivating. I mean, we've gone from, you know, nuclear, just listening to the whole overarching story here, we've gone from, you know, nuclear power being this lightning rod to being, you know, the lightning rod has become a lighthouse. You know, this is now.
The lightning rod, the lighthouse. I like that.
Yeah. You know, we're moving in the direction, you know, of this new lighthouse, which was once the lightning rod. And you know, we really only have ourselves to blame, right? I mean, as countries, of course.
Yeah, I think the nuclear industry has also not done a great job of working its own PR in the last 20 years. It's pretty astounding how wrong some of the takes on nuclear are, and it's easy for me to see that because I had those same opinions, you know, just, you know, 6-7 years ago. So it's great to see that come around. And, you know, it's a global market, right? And it's a global market for everything pretty much these days. And that's, I think that it's, the world is deglobalizing a little bit, but it's been a global market. So the fact that the United States has been able to operate its fleet with producing almost zero uranium since, you know, kind of the early 2000s, let's say, we've been able to rely on Russia, and we've been able to rely on Canada and Kazakhstan and Australia and Namibia, and all of our global partners have been able to provide what we need in that front. But of course, seeing geopolitical tensions arise, seeing supply chain interruptions from COVID, from war, whatever it might be, puts the grid at risk. It literally could put the grid at risk. And so we've just this year banned the importation of Russian uranium into the United States starting in 2028. And that actually becomes law in about 3 weeks. But there are waivers being offered by the Department of Energy from between now and 2028. They just announced that they gave a waiver to Centrus, probably because Centrus was awarded the RFP for HALEU. There was another RFP for high assay low enriched uranium, because these demonstration projects in the United States, both of them, both TerraPower's Natrium and X Energy's XE100, both of these operate on HALEU, and we don't have any HALEU. So, and rather than buying it from Russia, which is the only maker of HALEU, the DOE said, okay, we're going to buy it, but you guys have to make it. So Centrus is working on that. But they need their feedstock, and their feedstock in the near term comes from a legacy contract with Russia. So it's a very complicated market, but that's all to say that it has significantly bifurcated in the last 2 years because of the war in Ukraine. And the Western world, as part of that, the Western world has been making an attempt to shore up the fuel cycle in its own production, and especially in the United States. So regardless of how things end up in terms of geopolitical tensions or not between the United States and Russia, it's a positive for us to have all elements of the domestic nuclear fuel cycle shored up for the sake of the operational consistency of our grid.
Well, energy independence, I mean, that's going to be a thing.
Yep.
And puts a whole new, I mean, you know, you mentioned centrifuges, and, you know, if you watched, you know, watching the news over the last, you know, decade or two, you know, with regards to Iran, for example, you know, every now and then it came up that Iran was, you know, building centrifuges. Their nuclear scientists are trying to refine uranium, you know, for their atomic program. And then that's just been this political football that has been going back and forth for the last couple of decades. And, when you put it in perspective that Russia is the biggest refiner of uranium, you know, it just makes you scratch your head and think, like, how did we allow that to happen? It's the same story with Germany. And again, Germany at the center of the whole nuclear debacle, closing all of its nuclear facilities, nuclear generation, power generation facilities in favor of coal and buying nuclear power from France. You know, Germany was caught on the back foot as well because of the Nord Stream pipeline, you know, all the and oil from Russia that it was, had come to depend on over the last several decades. Now, you know, now we've got this reversal that's happened over the last, you know, four years. And Germany vulnerable to its energy requirements because of that past dependency. But again, it's all part of that same ecosystem, you know, of globalization. And now that we're in this trend of deglobalization and nearshoring, you know, we're realizing, like, wow, we really let this thing go for too long and really had too much faith in Gorbachev's policy, you know, thinking that, you know, Putin, who has really, you know, reversed everything over the last two decades, has really, it's an eye opener when you consider that, and then to see, you know, how that plays back into this whole uranium cycle. It's been a very long, you know, protracted downtrend for uranium. And now we're heading into this period, you know, just like the regime change in economics, in macroeconomics, we're having with interest rates and inflation, we're heading into this, you know, new multi-decade cycle of expansion into these areas and rethinking, you know, the way the, you know, rethinking the geopolitical landscape or rethinking energy altogether.
The war in Ukraine really put a highlight on the fact that energy can be weaponized, and that has led to an increased interest for nations to protect their own energy security. So aside from the clean energy desires, let's say, of many countries, literally making sure that you can keep the lights on is also important. So that has influenced a lot of the sentiment around nuclear for multiple reasons. I would argue that the primary reason is that A, it's baseload. It can operate for 80 plus years, a single reactor with some upkeep, right? Some maintenance along the way. But it's so unbelievably energy dense that a country like Japan that has very little energy resources and imports, 90-something percent, I believe, of their energy needs in terms of natural gas and coal, uranium, things like that. They can store decades worth of energy, let's call it potential, in the form of nuclear fuel rods in a small warehouse.
Right.
And that is so much more secure than having to rely on a ship full of coal arriving every single day at the port to keep the lights on. So it's a huge advantage in terms of energy density and energy security. And your comments about Germany are right on. Germany basically decided to engage in an energy policy that was driven by ideals rather than by physics. And they invested $500 billion into wind and solar over the past 15 years, a program called Energiewende. And that did not produce the electricity that they had hoped it would. This is wind and solar, highly intermittent. Of course, Germany's pretty far north, to speak generally, doesn't have the sunniest weather. So solar, I don't know why they moved so deeply into that realm. But yes, you're absolutely right. They shut off their last three reactors, I believe, about 18 months ago. And since then, they've had to drastically increase their coal production. And
they traded the environment. The natural gas pipeline got destroyed due to the war in Ukraine. And they immediately started burning coal by the freaking truckload. Right. Yep. So, I mean, it power or environmental friendliness, we're going to have power regardless. And the environmental outcome to some degree is a bit of a side thing, especially in a short term situation. So you've got this very, I'll call it a bullish story on clean energy, energy security, geopolitical nearshoring and supply chain securitization across the board. And so you have an opportunity in uranium. I think we've painted that really, really quite concisely thus far. So now maybe we can move to how does an investor take advantage of this? What are the ways in which investors can think through this potential opportunity, you know, as you know, probably an explore part of their portfolio, maybe part of their energy section of their portfolio. The one thing that's astounding to me is with the run in mega caps and the S&P 500 as an example, only 4% of that index is now dedicated to energy. It in 2009, it gets up to 16 to 20%, but those people who have, you know, just an S&P position have 4% exposure to energy stocks and 1% exposure to material stocks. And so that represents a bit of a slant in a less diversified portfolio if we have any kind of energy situations. So to me, it's not just that, hey, this is a neat explore idea, but from a diversification perspective in a broader portfolio, you probably should think about what happens in any kind of energy embargo or energy crisis, and how you might think about adding things to your portfolio that will enhance returns in those situations. Not to mention the fact that, you know, the uranium trade, whether it's stocks or trying to get access to U3O, is a volatile one. So it should be, and I know, Justin, you emphasize this in your newsletter constantly. This is volatile, so don't be shaken out. Make sure your position size is small enough that you can handle the vagaries along the way in order to get to the potential for outsized returns and the potential to hedge your portfolio from an energy perspective. But what are the ways in which investors can express an interest in this area?
Well, you know, I would say before Justin responds, you know, 4% sounds like a pretty good allocation. Market weight.
Well, right? Yeah, 4% is what you have in the S&P 500. It's historically low.
So yeah.
Typically that runs between, you know, 12 and 16% and gets as high as 20%. Because of the run in mega caps, what people have is a historically low exposure to anything energy related in their portfolio from an energy perspective, and a historically high exposure in their portfolio to tech related energy using companies. And so there's an imbalance there. You know, and most people, you know, if you don't want to deal with it, don't deal with it. This is for those who might want to think a little bit differently.
But the imbalance is interesting because the imbalance is being caused by the Magnificent Seven, mm-hmm. which are driving, you know, the hype and getting the valuations in lieu of their you know, inroads into AI. So the very thing that is driving up that overvalued or getting, you know, highly valued portion of the market that's crowding out the energy weight of the S&P 500, for example, and other indices. It's a rising tide, but this rising tide should lift the energy boat in general, but very specifically when you drill down into the uranium sector, which is even more undervalued, it makes sense to offset some of the allocations to the high valuation portion of the market into this low valuation area, lower valuation of energy and uranium, to, you know, rebalance into that area. Since it's the AI sector or the AI driven sector that's going to be drawing the energy requirements, a lot of the energy requirements from something like nuclear, right? It makes sense to, there's a connection there, right? It makes sense to
of course,
you know, put it into nuclear. Yeah, that's where we're
energy,
trying to make here is
electrons,
this case.
Ergo nuclear is an AI play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all AI.
It's almost like what are the second order, third order effects of this trend, right? I mean, the first order effect is you buy NVIDIA. Or whatever other AI generating
Microsoft
stock.
Amazon data centers, all the things that are doing, they're using the energy to do these things.
Right. And you know, the utility stocks have done very well over the past year, and part of the reason is just the recognition of this electricity demand, and that those investment flows have yet to really flow down into the uranium sector. It's a very, very small sector. It's not that liquid for very large money managers. So if you're talking, if funds that are, you know, $1 billion and larger, they have a hard time doing anything in the sector now. As the liquidity improves, we believe that that'll be kind of like a snowball effect, and we'll see more money come in simply due to liquidity. So, you know, we speak pretty frequently with some of the larger funds that are dedicated in the uranium space, and, you know, they talk to other money managers all the time, and somebody's like, okay, I get the thesis. I'd like to make an allocation to the sector. All they do is they pull up their Bloomberg and put a little bit of money into the top three most liquid stocks. They're not going to do some forward cash flow analysis. They're not going to do any sort of fundamental deep dive. They get the thesis overall. They need liquidity. So most of the smaller cap, mid cap stocks, you know, anywhere from a couple million dollars up to, let's say, 500 million, right? And there's about 100 of those stocks in the uranium space. There's thousands in the gold and silver space. There's 100 in the uranium space. And most of those are held by ETFs. And when the money flows into the ETFs buy those underlying holdings, and they can move very, very violently in both directions. So yes, right. Mike, it's extremely volatile. It's one of those sectors where you really have to hang on to your hat. You really have to invest start off small and make sure that you can stomach the volatility would be my general recommendations for somebody just entering this sector. Enter into positions in tranches. This is like the general recommendations we make over and over to our newsletter base, right? Enter into positions in tranches because it's so volatile. You can have a 5 or 10% down day. And if you're out of cash, you can't take advantage of that. So never be out of cash, by the way. You don't ever want to be 100% invested. You want to maintain diversification. There's no exceptions to this investment thesis that you wouldn't want to adhere to for general investing principles, right? Make a logical allocation that's reasonable for your own age and risk tolerance and investment goals, okay? You have to have patience because it's very difficult to time this market. You don't know exactly when things are going to move. And a dozen times since I've been following this investment, something absolutely unforeseen came out of left field and moved the sector to the upside or the downside, but especially to the upside because the sentiment swings so wildly in this sector that people literally just throw in the towel and capitulate after a 20% down move in the sector. And then something comes along and the stocks will be up 10%. And you can have a portfolio-wide 10% up or down day. That's this type of sector. Okay. You can have a good year in a couple of hours. And this sector, the opportunity here is that the energy demand that is growing is going to have second and third order effects. And we've yet to see the money really rotate out of quote unquote growth into value, out of tech into energy. And we think that's going to be a big theme for the next 5 to 10 years. And it doesn't seem to be slowing. So eventually the investment will have to go there because these companies can't survive without it. And they're going to need it in order to develop the assets to fuel this quote unquote green revolution, this tech revolution that's happening. And the opportunity for uranium is that you can't have a nuclear power plant operating and not buy uranium. You can overspend on it. You can, but you just can't let that unit fail, right? You can't not have the fuel for your reactor. It's a multi-billion dollar, highly valuable asset, and it can't be without its juice. Mm-hmm. So uranium itself is about 4 to 6% of the operating budget of a nuclear power plant. So the price of that can and will go up drastically, and nuclear operators have to buy it. And so that makes it kind of unique. The demand is relatively easy to model out compared to some other sectors, right? Like oil, you always have this unforeseen situation with OPEC. What is OPEC going to do? And that can move the market substantially just from an OPEC meeting saying they're going to increase or they're going to decrease, right? You don't really have that type of influence in this sector. Kazakhstan might be the closest thing to OPEC for uranium, but they've got all sorts of supply issues. They've been saying for a couple of years they're going to increase production. They just can't do it. It's very difficult for them to do it. So you have a small sector. When funds flow into this sector, the moves are very violent and volatile. That attracts people to it. It also turns people off from the sector. If you want to buy a dividend blue chip that's going to move 0.5% up or down in a day, it's probably not your type of sector. But if you want torque to this trend of growing energy demand, uranium, in my opinion, is one of the better ways to play it. Most of the investment opportunities in the space are in the mining stocks. There's, like I said, there's 120, 130 mining stocks in the space, somewhere around there. There was about 50 or 60, like 3 to 4 years ago. So it's been growing. The trend has been recognized, right? But I would say probably the easiest and safest way, if there is a safe way to invest in this sector, would be to invest in the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust or Yellowcake, which is based in London. Yellowcake seems to trade at a more persistent, larger discount to its net asset value. But Sprott, if you just are bullish on the theme and you think uranium price is going up, Sprott Physical Trust is a great way to play it. Has great liquidity, and it's an unleveraged way to just bet on a rising commodity. You can buy it when it's at a steep discount to NAV. It goes through its own cycles, going back up to NAV. When they're at a premium to NAV, they can issue shares through an ATM, raise some cash, buy uranium. So they're holding 63 million pounds of uranium right now. That uranium can't be sold back into the market without, I think it's a two-thirds investor approval, which would never happen. So effectively, that's uranium heaven, and it's not leaving. But you can get torque with mining stocks, right? So our portfolio is primarily made up of developing and producing companies. There aren't that many producing companies, but there are quite a few developing companies. We like to own companies that will eventually be real companies producing something and creating cash flow. And you can also just buy the ETFs. But if you have a pointed investment strategy and you've done some work on the companies, you can pretty significantly outperform the ETFs. So our focus list portfolio of uranium stocks has outperformed URA by almost a factor of two, including the dividends for URA. So you can outperform the market. And in some cases, there's really, really incredible torque for the uranium mining stocks. And when the commodity starts to move, typically the miners will outperform the commodity on the upside. Yeah. We'll underperform it on the downside. So where we're at now, to wrap this up, where we're at now in valuations for the sector, we are basically at the same valuation with the mining stocks versus the metal as we were when the bull market started back in December 2020. So in my opinion, there's immense, immense growth potential for this sector. The stocks are not pricing in where we think this commodity is going. And it's currently about $85, $84 spot uranium, about $80 long-term uranium, peaked out at 106 in late January, just earlier this year, pulled back a bit. It's been consolidating for some time. We think we're possibly weeks away from the next move. I usually don't like to say things like that, but uranium is very cyclical. There is news coming out of Cameco in Kazakhstan next month in August. And then you have the WNA conference in September. A bunch of utilities get new budgets in October. There's always a lot of activity in Q3 and Q4 for uranium. So following a long period of consolidation and poor sentiment, which is where we're at right now, usually there's a move to the upside during a secular long-term bull market.
Well, and we've had a you know, sort of a beautiful breakout that's occurred on the, you know, if you look at uranium as a chart, 22, 23 coming into 24, nice piercing of that, and a wonderful little pullback that we're in right now. If people are looking at, as you already mentioned, tranching in, and I'm assuming that, you know, the large caps are probably much more reasonably valued than some of the small and mid caps, as you're talking about this, just because you said that most folks, when they're going to buy Cameco and a couple of other very large plays in very safe jurisdictions just to get some exposure, hasn't really trickled down yet. And so I'll ask you to confirm that. And then on top of that, or the next question is, as you're seeing the sort of the DCF analysis of some of the mines and the companies, where are they putting the uranium price as they do that? Because that's, you know, you've got your discounted cash flows, but they're going to be based on the commodity price. And what you tend to see is early stages, that DCF is like, it's going to be 80, we're going to discount it to 65, and this is what the company's worth. And then as you go through the period where you maybe should be a little bit more worried, you'll see these companies, I know the long-term price is 80, but we're pricing it at 120 just because it's been going up for so long, it's never going to stay at 80. I don't think we're in the latter stage. I think we're probably in the more former stage of that. But what are you seeing just generally across the tranches of the cap weight and the discounted cash flow models that you're seeing on valuations?
I think that to say what I think should be done in terms of DCF, I would say the most appropriate price to plug into that model would be the expected incentive price for the marginal projects to produce, because they're going to have to produce in the demand environment that we project. So that incentive price is north of $100 a pound. So if you want to do a conservative DCF, you'd probably price it at $100 a pound and give yourself, you know, a 10% discount rate or whatever it might be. Right. And that would give you, I would say, that would put most miners in the space at very low valuations in this environment. The most of the DCFs that I see done are at lower price uranium, or the present price of uranium.
Right.
because nobody really knows, myself included, where this is going and what is the appropriate price to plug in. I would argue that a responsibly appropriate price to plug into those models would be north of $100 a pound, because it's going to have to be there and stay there for some time for the projects, the big projects that, when I say big, I mean big in CapEx, not even necessary in uranium production, but some of the big, like lower grade projects in Namibia, let's say, that their own feasibility studies, you know, 2 years ago were putting in $65, $70 a pound uranium. So as they update those feasibility studies, that's going to look better for these companies, obviously. But these are, you know, $300, $400, $500, $600, $700 million CapEx development projects. And they're not going to take that financial risk in developing these projects without a certain amount of long-term contracting on the books to de-risk that development. So long story short, the development projects, they have to have a certain amount of their forward production secured in long-term contracts to de-risk the financing. And they're not going to do that at low prices. Okay. So it's a seller's market right now. The current producers and the developing projects have the upper hand. And right now, like, we're seeing very, very low volumes of uranium being contracted this year, 31.5 million pounds year to date. The sector is going to consume about 190 million pounds this year of uranium. Why are they sitting on the fence? The price doubled from August of last year to January. That's a huge move for a commodity, and the whole sector is still trying to digest that move. And the utilities are not wanting to pay these prices, and the producers are not dropping their ask. And so you have a little bit of headbutting. And I hate to say it, but the utilities, you're going to have to pay it, because the producers are not going to voluntarily drop their pricing, because they just went through a decade and a half of hell to arrive at this moment in time where finally the tables have turned and they can make some money. Nobody wants to build a mine. Mining sucks. It's really hard, and no one wants to do it. So nobody is going to do it to break even. And that's kind of the environment we're in right now.
And so that's reflected in your valuation too. You said earlier about how inexpensive the stocks are given the new paradigm that we're in now. Even though that the prices may be a little bit higher than they were a few years ago, the valuation is actually lower.
Right, exactly. And honestly, you don't see a lot of DCS being done around the sector because the assumptions are just so difficult to make. And most companies are never going to produce anything anyways. So if you can go on their feasibility study, if they have one, and say, okay, you're planning on producing this amount of uranium this year. Okay, well, where is that price going to be? What discount rate are you going to plug in? It's almost worthless in this sector to go off of valuations with that model. So you don't actually see it very often. But when you see it, it's usually done on the current pricing environment. And in our estimation, that's going to prove to be outdated relatively quickly. You have companies like Cameco that you could argue based on their PE ratio or whatever it might be that it's overvalued. But Cameco owns 49% of Westinghouse. Westinghouse has their hands in 95% of the world's nuclear reactor fleet in some way or another. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to gauge the potential valuation of that acquisition. And I think it's the upside is absolutely huge. So how do you value that? Nobody knows. I don't know. If you go just off of their uranium mining business, you could probably argue that they're slightly overvalued at these prices. But it's the most liquid stock in the space besides, I think, UEC and the Sprott Trust. And so institutions buy it. It's a great story. They are going to have vertical integration across the fuel cycle with the exception of enrichment until Global Laser Enrichment is developed someday. But they've got uranium mining. They have conversion in Port Hope. They potentially will have enrichment. They have fuel fabrication through Westinghouse. And now they actually have their hands in building reactors in this nuclear renaissance. Like, what is that worth? What could that be worth?
And today, as we talked, it's sitting right around its 50-week or 200-day moving average, pulled back nicely in an orderly uptrend. So, you know, some of the things we're talking about, now we're talking on July 22nd, so I'm not, when this airs, when you might be listening to this, it might be a slightly different time frame. But the, you know, just through happenstance, you know, the timing of us getting together in a very, you know, sort of bullish sector as we've laid out with reasonable valuations in a pullback, it's an interesting place to put a tranche on, if you will.
It is. And you can chart the seasonality for uranium stocks relatively easily. And over the past 20 years, Q3, Q4 have been the strongest, especially Q3, leading into the sector for uranium. So following a consolidation, it feels a lot like last year, to be completely honest. And some of the reasons why is that you have a quiet period, you have low sentiment, you have a pullback in the equities, but also for the physical market, you have a very, very tight physical market because of the undersupply, the situation that is persistent. There's not a lot of inventories and it doesn't take a lot of buying pressure to move it. So last year we had a couple of things that, in my opinion, really set the sector up to run pretty hard in the last 3-4 months of the year. And that was two pretty large RFPs that came into the market. One was from PG&E that had just officially been announced they were going to be able to extend Diablo Canyon in California for 5 years. So as soon as that was definitely happening, they came into the market and said, hey, we need a lot of uranium. We need it now. And what that did is it kind of shook up the physical market a little bit because it took some time for that RFP to get filled, and it showed how tight the market was because of how long it took and what it did to the price. The price moved up a couple of bucks. Then about 2-3 months later, the Koreans came in with a large RFP as well. And Korea has done a 180. Their newest administration has completely done a 180. They canceled their nuclear phase out project. They restarted a construction of two reactors that had stopped under the previous administration. So the Korean utility came into the market with a big RFP that still hasn't been filled. This came, I think it was last June that RFP hit the market. So these, and that was just two buyers last year that shook up the market and led to this price rise. And then the Kazakhs came in and said, we're not going to be able to reach our production targets. And the market went crazy in January. So all it's going to take in our estimation right now is either a big RFP coming in or a large utility stepping up and signing a large long-term contract at the present pricing environment. Because what that's going to do is it's not only going to show how tight the market is, but it's going to be justification for any other utility that has future needs that need to be covered to actually accept this pricing environment and move forward with those needs. So it's a little bit of a stalemate right now, but the reasons for that stalemate are temporary phenomena. It's pulling forward material. It's flexing up on old contracts. I know we don't have the time to talk about that, but the utilities have done what they could. They pulled on every lever possible to avoid signing very large long-term contracts. And there isn't a lot of flex in the system yet. It's very fragile. You don't have to know what is going to break it. Just know that it's fragile enough that something, anything can happen that can shake this up. A big buyer stepping in. The Kazakhs again announcing potentially 10 days from now that they're not going to hit their 2025 production targets either. That sort of thing can move this market in a big, big way. So it's fragile, it's undersupplied, the demand picture is improving, and we expect that we have multiple years left in this investment thesis because we don't see supply matching demand potentially ever. But if everything goes right, and of course it always does in mining, right? If Cameco reaches 24 million pounds a year at the MacArthur, if Global Atomic can develop Dasa in Niger, if the Kazakhs can ramp, the Uzbeks can ramp, if Russia can get one of their mines they're working on online, if US ISR projects come online, there's a lot of these development projects that if NextGen's Arrow and Phoenix and Saskatchewan, two large projects, if those all come online, if all of that happens, maybe 2029, 2030, we see the market balance for a point in time for maybe a year or two. But we've got decline rates of the existing mines as well with a demand rising backdrop. So it's a very, very robust looking supply and demand situation going out into the future. Eventually, high enough prices for long enough will incentivize enough supply. If we see really high prices, we're going to see technologies that don't exist now come into play, whether that's seawater extraction, whether it's phosphate extraction. These things will happen eventually. But the opportunity right now is that we have 3, 4, 5 years before supply can even come close to meeting demand. And during that period of time, there's still a lot of buying utilities have to do. We expect that's going to move the market pretty substantially.
Yeah, that's pretty typical commodity cycle, as you outlined earlier on too. And I mean, sure, something that we've seen in natural gas, right? We saw the early noughts have, you know, huge spikes in natural gas prices, which brought on Marcellus Shale and had massive amounts of natural gas hit the market. So there will be an ebb and flow at the moment that the sector seems to be ebbing. And, you know, you ink a long-term contract at 80 or 90, and all of a sudden that trickles down into every project. All of a sudden, you know, those developers who are developing potential resources and mines have a pathway with a DCF cash flow of a price of an underlying commodity that justifies the build out, which and eventually brings on the supply that, you know, stabilizes the price and potentially makes the price drop. But that's, as you said, Justin, in your opinion, that's going to be at minimum 5 years away. And that provides for a wonderful investment opportunity.
I agree.
Justin, that was fascinating. That's a really fascinating take and really comprehensive look at uranium. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and, of course, your insight into this very unique space.
It's been my pleasure. Yeah, I've always enjoyed talking about this stuff, and it's great to meet you guys, and congrats on your podcast, and thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks. By the way, I'm a paying subscriber as well, so I think Justin presents a very fair and a very thoughtful way to think about this sector and think about allocating to the sector, and we've covered a little bit of that today. But I think there's lots there. If this interests you, it's probably a great place to start digging in a little deeper.
Thanks for the kind words, Mike, and for the support, of course. Yeah.
Thank you, Justin.
Cheers, guys. My pleasure.